Well, welcome all. Greetings and welcome to the first teleclass of 2005. It is Managing Urinary Tract Infections in Long-Term Care. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I would like to tell you how pleased we are that you have joined this teleclass today. And if this is your first teleclass experience, we are particularly pleased to have you along. Welcome all. During a teleclass last June, Dr. Chesley Richards of the CDC in Atlanta made reference to the work of a certain Dr. Lindsay Nicole on several of his slides. At one point, he even acknowledged verbally that Dr. Nicole is the, and I'm quoting here, the world's leading authority on urinary tract infections. Of course, it was at that very moment that I made a note to myself to ask or beg or bribe her to give a teleclass in 2005, and thankfully begging and bribery weren't necessary. She is here with us today. Dr. Lindsay Nicole is a physician and infection control specialist. Her academic and clinical work have produced numerous articles, and she is a regular speaker at CHICA and APIC conferences and many other conferences, really too many to note. She's very, very popular, very smart lady. It's a real honor to have her with us today. She has a lot to say on the topic, so I'll let her get to it. To bring us the teleclass, Urinary Tract Infections in Long-Term Care, from the Health Sciences Center in Winnipeg, Manitoba, I am pleased to present Dr. Lindsay Nicole. Dr. Nicole.
Thanks very much, Paul, and thank you for a very kind introduction. First of all, let me welcome everybody who's joining us today. We're going to talk about the topic of urinary tract infection in residents of long-term care facilities, and this is a huge topic, and it is very complex. There's no way that we could possibly handle all aspects of it today, and so what we're going to be doing is primarily focusing on a couple of issues. One of them, the whole issue of asymptomatic bacteriuria, and then something that follows from that whenever you start talking about asymptomatic bacteriuria, the issue of what is symptomatic infection? How do you make a diagnosis of symptomatic infection in long-term care facility residents? I'm not going to talk about specific choices for antimicrobial therapy because that's really no different in the long-term care facility population than anywhere else, but I will be talking a little bit about when you decide to use antimicrobial treatment. And finally, I'm just going to touch on the issue of when, if ever, should we be doing investigations in these long-term care individuals who have urinary tract infection. So let's start by talking about asymptomatic bacteriuria. Now, asymptomatic bacteriuria is the presence of bacteria which meet quantitative standards that tell us that they're in the urine rather than contaminants, but no signs or symptoms which are referable to those bacteria. And this is exceedingly common in long-term care facility populations. Your slide 3 really summarizes 6 studies which were done in Canada, the United States, and some in Europe as well, and shows the prevalence of bacteriuria, what proportion of women or men had positive urine cultures at any point in time. And you can see from these studies that anywhere from 17 to 55% of women had a positive urine culture, and anywhere from 15 to 37% of men. So upwards of half of all women in long-term care facilities and upwards of one-third of all men in long-term care facilities have got a positive urine culture at any time. Many of you who have been working in long-term care facilities will be aware of this, but for many individuals who haven't been working in long-term care facilities, this is rather a startling statistic. So just to show you a little bit more to convince you, the next slide, slide 4, which is a graph, just shows one of our own studies that we actually did over 20 years ago now. In fact, this was the first study that I ever did. Well, let's make it the second study I ever did in a long-term care facility. And we had a long-term care facility here for veterans in Winnipeg. There were two wards, that's Ward 1 and Ward 2. And we did obtained urine specimens for culture from every single individual on those two wards who did not have a chronic indwelling catheter 3 times over a year period, so separated by 4 months. And what this shows you is that on those two wards, 40% of all of our non-catheterized old men had a positive urine culture any time we did the survey on either ward. Now, some of them also had smaller quantitative counts. That's the lighter color at the top of the graph, and some of those really are bacteriuria and some of them are contamination, but there's no easy way to tell the difference. Another study coming from the United States is some of the work that the Philadelphia group has done with Aberton, They surveyed every 6 months over a period of about 4 years, as you can see here, and that's the survey column on the left. And they looked at elderly women who were resident in the community, but in situations where they were given some help. That's the LCC. The CL were a group of individuals who required even more care, and then NH is the nursing home. What you can see is that over this four-year period, for the most functionally adept women who were not, in fact, in nursing homes, the prevalence of bacteriuria varied with different surveys from 7 to about 13.5%. As they became more functionally impaired, that prevalence increased and averaged about 20%, and then the nursing home population had the highest prevalence. But it didn't matter when you did these surveys, there was always a high proportion of these women who had positive urine cultures. Now, the finding, the presence of a positive urine culture or bacteriuria in an individual who's resident in a long-term care facility is not random. You know which of these residents are most likely to have positive urine cultures. And those are the individuals who have the most comorbid illnesses and are the most functionally impaired. Again, this is the Aberton study from Philadelphia, and they associated for elderly ambulatory women. So these are the ones who are still up and walking around and not the most ill in the nursing home, that the individuals who were most likely to have bacteriuria were older, had a greater number of chronic disease diagnoses, were taking more medications, had decreased activities of daily living, had decreased mental status, decreased walking ability, so the functional status was poor. So it's the most functionally impaired, it's the sickest, if you will, of the long-term care facility women who are most likely to have positive urine cultures. And this is the same for men. This is our own study, the one that I showed you the graph from. And for elderly men, the ones that were likely to have a positive urine culture were those who had the greatest impairment of mental status and who were incontinent of urine and incontinent of bowel. We didn't find any association with number of diagnoses, duration of residence, mobility, or age. This may have been a study number thing, or it may in fact be a true difference for men or women. In fact, what we found in this group of men was what you might want to describe as a dose response curve with respect to bacteriuria and functional status. If you take a look at slide number 8, and these are our elderly men that we were studied, we followed them up over a period of 3 years, in fact, and obtained on a routine basis urine cultures from them. And then we divided them up into three groups: those that always had a positive urine culture every time we did it, those that sometimes had positive urine cultures and sometimes had negative urine cultures, and those sometimes negative were usually because they'd had antibiotics or something, and those who never had a urine culture. And what you can see here is that the proportion that were confused or demented was 42%, of those who never had a positive urine culture, but 78% of those who always had a positive urine culture, and in between for those with an intermittently positive urine culture. Same observation for urine incontinence or bowel incontinence, and a trend with respect to ambulance status, but not a significant difference. So functional status is something that is highly associated with the presence of bacteriuria. Now, it may be as simple as the fact that if you have confusion and dementia, you're more likely to have urine and bowel incontinence, and you're also likely to have some impairment of appropriate voiding. And so it may be what we consider to be a neurogenic bladder. They aren't emptying their bladders properly. It could be as simple as that. Another factor which has a major role to play in men is that many incontinent men in long-term care facilities are managed with external condom catheters. And external condom catheter use is associated with an increased frequency of bacteriuria. And I'm not saying that that's a reason why you shouldn't use condom catheters, but that will explain some of the prevalence of bacteriuria that we see in some men who are functionally impaired in long-term care facilities. So there is a lot of asymptomatic bacteriuria in residents of long-term care facilities, and in fact, we should expect to find it. So that if you do a urine specimen for culture from any resident of a long-term care facility, there is a high probability that that will be positive at any time, irrespective of what sort of clinical symptoms they have. Now, there are a number of excellent studies that have been done which are prospective, randomized comparative trials of treating asymptomatic bacteriuria in long-term care facility residents with antibiotics or not treating them with antibiotics and looking at outcomes. These studies are absolutely consistent in their observations. And these observations are that if you treat asymptomatic bacteriuria, if you have that positive urine culture and you give somebody an antibiotic for it, there will be no decrease in the presence of chronic symptoms in that individual. You will not decrease the frequency of symptomatic urinary infections that that individual may subsequently experience. You do not, in fact, decrease the prevalence of bacteriuria beyond a period of a couple of weeks after the antibiotics, and there is no change in the mortality of those individuals. But what you do, and these are all significant associations in at least one of these studies, you increase the number of adverse drug effects associated with the use of antimicrobial therapy. You will increase the rate of subsequent bacteriuria with organisms that are more resistant to the antibiotics that have been used, and of course you will increase the overall costs of caring for that patient. So that there is, in fact, compelling information that says you should not treat asymptomatic bacteriuria in a long-term care facility resident with antibiotics. Again, I'm going to show you just a few examples from some of our own studies to give you a clearer idea of this. These are our elderly men, again, one of the first studies we did. We had 16 randomized to antibiotics, 20 to no antibiotics, and we followed these individuals up for 2 years. And during that two-year period, that 16 randomized to antibiotics, whenever we got a positive urine culture, we treated them. So they spent a lot of time on antibiotics. The treatment group did not have a decreased rate of anything. Okay, the rate of pneumonia was pretty similar between the two groups. The rate of what I'm calling a febrile episode, and we'll return to this a little bit later on, but basically that's a fever is documented to be present, and there is no localizing findings to say where it's coming from. Absolutely no different between the treated and not treated group. There were two symptomatic episodes in the therapy group, both epididymo orchitis. Remember, we're only dealing with men in this study, and two in the no therapy group, one of whom had a positive blood culture, and in fact that could have been from a wound infection as well as the urine because they had the same bugs in them, and the other was post-cystoscopy sepsis. But in fact, that post-cystoscopy sepsis was an individual who, even though they were randomized to no therapy, had received a dose of antibiotics prior to the cystoscopy because that is an indication for treatment. So this study clearly documented no benefits whatsoever with treating asymptomatic bacteriuria. And again, this is the mortality that we observed over that two-year period. You can see that there was no difference whatsoever in mortality between the group that was randomized to therapy and that was randomized to no antibiotics. And in fact, if anything, there was a trend to increase mortality in the group who was randomized to therapy. And I think we could develop some theories of why that might be the case. But in fact, there's no significant difference between these two lines. Again, I'd just like to show you some pictures from individual patients because it helps get your mind around this whole issue of just how common and ordinary bacteriuria is in this group of individuals. This is one of our old men. He was 68 years old with Parkinson's disease and dementia, and he had a normal IVP. He was randomized to treatment, and you can see over this two-year period, 1980-1981, we kept treating him with antibiotics, the ones that we were commonly using for urinary infection at that time. Every time we gave him some antibiotics, we cleared up the urine for a short period of time. Those are the open boxes that you're seeing. But within a month, usually he reinfected, and as we gave him longer courses of antibiotic therapy, he serially reinfected with more resistant organisms. At the end, we gave him 12 weeks of TMPSMX because there is a recommendation for prostatic infection in men that you do that. But what you can see is that immediately after we discontinued 12 weeks, he had a positive urine culture again. And in fact, that E. coli that was growing at the end of 1981 was exactly the same E. coli that was growing there at the beginning of 1980. Now, it probably was in his prostate, in fact. But what this shows you is that you simply could not get rid of that positive urine culture by giving him antibiotics. Regardless of whether or not you actually did any good with it. And then we have a study that we did in women as well. This is a little bit later in the mid-80s. And again, we had actually 25 women in each group, 25 randomized to therapy, 25 to no therapy, and we followed them for a year. And again, you can see that there was a significant increase in antibiotic-related adverse events in those who received therapy. There was a significant increase in the emergence of resistant organisms, and there was no change in genital urinary morbidity. There were 20 episodes in 13 residents in the therapy group, 14 in 10 residents in the no therapy group, and these are really episodes that any possible episode that could be ascribed to urinary infection. But the ones that we were comfortable were in fact due to urinary infection were one episode of fever, which was a pyelonephritis in the no therapy group, hematuria, one in each group, and an increased frequency of acute dysuria in two women in the therapy group. I just want to say here that this observation of the acute dysuria occurring in our therapy group, so what that means is they were treated with antibiotics, one assumes that we cleared them for a short period of time. When they reinfected, they had an acute episode of dysuria and they had symptoms. This has been shown in other populations, including young girls and spinal cord injured patients, as well as in young women. But if you take somebody who has got asymptomatic bacteriuria and you treat that asymptomatic bacteriuria, you increase their frequency of symptomatic infection in the immediate post-antibiotic period. So this, in fact, fits quite neatly. But again, there's nothing here to suggest that by treating that asymptomatic bacteriuria, we improved outcomes for these women. We probably made them much worse looking at this data. And again here, if we look at the mortality data for the 1 year of follow-up that we had, you can see again that there was, in fact, there's no significant difference in these two, although I'll tell you at 12 months there, the p-value is 0.07, so it would have been interesting if we had, in fact, extended this study to 2 years as well. But if there's anything, there's a trend here to increase mortality with therapy. But certainly there is no benefit with, there is no adverse effect with not treating the bacteriuria. And again, just to show you some individual examples, these are two of the women we had on the study. This is a 91-year-old woman with Alzheimer's disease who was randomized to no antibiotics. You see that she basically just remained bacteriuric right through. They thought she was maybe getting some symptoms at the end there, and that's why she got some antibiotics. But what I would like to say about this one, which it actually doesn't show up in the slide here, is that she, in fact, in all the studies that we've ever done, she's the one patient who I think may actually have died from her urinary infection. And as you can see, she was randomized to no therapy. She actually died with a hyperosmolar coma at 12 weeks here. But that did not start until after they'd actually treated her with the antibiotics here. So once again, it's not the non-treatment of bacteriuria that was associated with that outcome. And this is just another case. This was an individual who was randomized to treatment, a 69-year-old with Alzheimer's disease, and almost impossible to get urine specimens from. So we were getting urine specimens whenever we had a chance. But what you can see here is that every time we could get a urine specimen from the lady, we would treat it. But then the very next time we were finally able to get a urine specimen again, she always had a positive culture again. So you're just wasting your time and energy trying to sterilize urine in long-term care facility residents. So really where this leads us is to the fact that we absolutely should not be treating asymptomatic bacteriuria. We should only be treating infection in long-term care facility residents when it's symptomatic. But then we come to the very difficult question of, well, what is symptomatic urinary tract infection in this population? Keep in mind that they may have many chronic symptoms that interfere with our ability to assess them. They certainly cannot, in most cases, communicate effectively with us. That may be because they're demented, it may be because of strokes, and who knows whether the actual presentations of urinary infection are different in this population than others. Another question is, well, if, you know, somewhere between 25 and 50% of all of these people have got positive urine cultures all the time, when should you be investigating? You know, we say in other groups of men in particular, you get a urine culture, they need to be investigated to find out why. But are we really going to recommend investigations for all the one-third of men in long-term care facilities who have positive urine cultures? Doesn't seem to make sense, does it? Well, symptomatic urinary infection is a problem in long-term care facility residents. It certainly is a very small problem relative to the vast amount of asymptomatic bacteriuria, but it still is a problem, and it's one that does need to be addressed appropriately. Studies of symptomatic urinary infection in long-term care facilities have reported rates of 0.1 to 2.4 per 1,000 days, They've reported that anywhere from 1 to 8% of transfers to acute care facilities for care are due to urinary tract infection. In fact, urinary tract infection is responsible for over half of all episodes of bacteremia that occur in long-term care facility residents. But this is almost always individuals who have chronic indwelling catheters, and we haven't been talking about those patients. If I remember my data, the presence of a chronic indwelling catheter in a long-term care facility resident increases the likelihood that they will have an episode of bacteremia by 40 times. So the bacteremia that's associated with urinary tract infection in long-term care facilities is primarily an issue related to a chronic indwelling catheters. We aren't really discussing that in this talk, but it is something that we need to recognize. And finally, it is unlikely that urinary tract infection is an important contributor to mortality in nursing home patients. You have to look very long and hard to find patients who actually die of urinary tract infection. And in the autopsy series that have been done, and there are a number of those that have been reported, the only infection that really kills these individuals is pneumonia. So urinary tract infection is not an important contributor to mortality. But we do think that urinary infection, and I'm on to slide 19 now here, remains the second most common cause of, and here I'm talking about symptomatic urinary infection, of infections in nursing homes. Respiratory infection is the most important, and then distant third and fourth are skin and soft tissue infection and gastrointestinal infections. I wanted to show you again these rates of 0.1 to 2.4 per 1,000 patient days. Now, that is a huge difference, isn't it? 20-time variability in reports, and this is a summary of about 15 different studies that have reported this. Well, this reflects the fact, again, that it is so difficult to really identify what is symptomatic urinary infection in these individuals. So many of them have positive urine cultures that you're likely to overcall just because they have a positive urine culture and other symptoms. If you use highly restrictive definitions, you end up in the 0.1 range. And all of these studies use different definitions with respect to what is a symptomatic urinary tract infection. Some of them probably called some things that were asymptomatic infection symptomatic. So there is a wide reported range, and the actual true incidence is somewhere in between that 0.1 and 2.4, probably. But the issue is, what is symptomatic urinary infection? And I can't answer that necessarily, and I certainly cannot necessarily answer for you the issue of what are the most common clinical presentations, but we can talk a little bit about what is not symptomatic urinary tract infection, and that helps to narrow it down. First, I'm showing you some data from a study. Again, this is the Philadelphia group, and Basha is the first author here. They were studying a number of women in a long-term care facility. These women were actually functionally pretty good. They were not demented so that they could answer questionnaires, and they were mobile. They identified women who were bacteriuric in this group who had asymptomatic bacteriuria, and they questioned them about symptoms that could potentially be associated with urinary infection. They then treated these individuals with antibiotics, and a few weeks later, when they had a negative urine culture, they asked them the same questions. And they found that there was absolutely no difference between the period of time when they had a positive urine culture or a negative urine culture with respect to complaints about incontinence. And the numbers here, that 1.5, they were working on a scale of 1 to 4, where 1 is good and 4 is bad. There was no difference in frequency or in urgency. And if we look at the next slide, there were no difference in any of these sort of general symptoms, which are not, in fact, related to directly attributable to the genital urinary tract. So they didn't want to eat, they had difficulty sleeping, they were tired, they didn't feel so well, they were weak. Again, there was no difference for these women when they had a positive urine culture and when they had a negative urine culture. Another very nice study, which was done in the United States as well, this is out in California, by Auslander. Again, he identified a group of women who had positive urine cultures and who were incontinent, so they had chronic incontinence. He then randomized these women to being treated with antibiotic therapy or not antibiotic therapy. to determine whether treating asymptomatic bacteriuria in any way improved their chronic incontinence. And in doing this study, they used some very careful measurements of incontinence. They were measuring the number of times a day these women were wet. They were measuring the weight of diapers to understand the volumes. So it's a very well done study. What you can see is that for 71 bacteriuric women, with an incontinence frequency of 34% at baseline, after they had been treated with antibiotics, and this is actually just a few days into their antibiotic course, there was no difference whatsoever in terms of the frequency of incontinence. The non-bacteriuric group were somewhat a little bit less incontinent to start with, and they, without having received any antibiotics, also had no change. So that women who have got chronic incontinence and positive urine cultures, you do not benefit that incontinence by treating that positive urine culture. Now, I think you do need to understand that women who have had stable incontinence, chronic incontinence, for a period of time, and it suddenly deteriorates so that suddenly they're having a lot more incontinence, or if they've never had incontinence and then suddenly they do have incontinence, that is acute deterioration, and that can be due to urinary tract infection. So if they have acute deterioration, yes. If it's chronic and they happen to have a positive urine culture, treating that urine culture is in no way going to help that incontinence. So we conclude that a positive urine culture in an individual with chronic genitourinary symptoms, or in fact in an individual who has vague and non-localizing chronic symptoms, is not symptomatic urinary infection. You're not going to make any difference in those symptoms by giving antibiotic therapy to that positive urine culture. Let's talk about pyuria, about pus in the urine. This is, again, a study that we did in the 80s. It was a localization study in elderly women with asymptomatic bacteriuria to determine how many had kidney infection and how many had bladder infection. It turned out it was about 50-50, and a previous study from England had shown the same thing. What you can see here is that virtually all of these women had pyuria. This is a logarithmic scale on the left. Anything over 10 white blood cells per high power field is abnormal. And you can see that 90% of these women had pyuria with their asymptomatic bacteriuria, and some of them had extraordinary levels of pyuria, as high as 10,000, as you can see there at the top. If we look at another group of older individuals, most of them men, some of them women, again, this is another of our studies, you can see that individuals who had bacteriuria with one organism, 97% of those had pyuria, 82% of those with multiple organisms. Individuals who had positive cultures but did not have high counts of organisms, so you're wondering about contamination, fully 85% of those had pyuria as well, and it may be because it was contamination from elsewhere in the genital urinary tract. It may be because many of these did, in fact, have real bacteriuria. And 59% of those with completely negative urine cultures had pyuria. And other studies have shown similar findings, and this is probably represents all those other abnormalities that these individuals have. But the point here is that pyuria tells you nothing about asymptomatic bacteriuria. And somebody who has got a positive urine culture almost always has got pyuria. People who don't have positive urine cultures in long-term care facilities also often do have pyuria. So you can't use the presence of pyuria to tell you whether or not there is bacteriuria. And if somebody is bacteriuric, you can't use the presence of pyuria to tell you whether or not they're symptomatic, because anybody who's bacteriuric has got pyuria. The one thing that screening tests for pyuria may be useful for in the long-term care population is if they are negative. Because if they are negative, there's a good negative predictive value for those individuals not having a urinary tract infection. And so it can be useful from that perspective. Just a few more slides about pyuria to convince you when I tell you this is not something you need to worry about, because this is something that that people always want to do. They always want to say, well, there's all sorts of pyuria, so I got to treat this. This, again, is some of our old men. And we followed them up for at least 3 years here. I'm just showing you what their levels of pyuria were. These were consistently bacteriuric over a period of 3 years. What you can see is they remained pyuric anytime we obtained a urine specimen from them. And a couple of them here, these are massive levels of pyuria, these higher levels on the right here. This is urine that is basically all pus. Now, as far as we could tell, there was absolutely nothing that happened to these guys. And in fact, we did a much larger study with 100 individuals who were bacteriuric. We've never been able to show that the presence of pyuria or the amount of pyuria has any negative outcomes. And in particular, it has no influence on mortality. And this is shown to you in slide 27 here, which are our group of 100 elderly men and women that we were following for outcomes. And we stratified them. Of course, they all had positive urine cultures, so they all had pyuria. So we stratified them as a lower level of pyuria, that's the less than 100, an intermediate level of pyuria, that's 100 to 1,000, and a very high level of pyuria over 1,000. And this over 1,000, that's basically just almost solid pus coming out in the urine. And what you can see is if you look at mortality for these three groups, it absolutely is not correlated with the level of pyuria at all. So we have just not been able to find that pyuria tells you anything. And the appropriate conclusion from all of that is that a positive urine culture with pyuria is not symptomatic urinary infection. So if you have somebody, you send a urine specimen, you get a whole bunch of pyuria there, don't think that that means that they have to be treated for urinary tract infection. That is asymptomatic bacteriuria. The pyuria is irrelevant. Well, there's another big question here. What about these long-term care facility residents? So many of them have got positive urine cultures, and then they get a fever. When is that fever urinary tract infection? Because as you well know, if you have a resident in a long-term care facility who's got a positive urine culture, who has a fever, and you can't see any other reason for that fever, you're going to call that a urinary tract infection, and it's going to be treated as a urinary tract infection. So is it a urinary tract infection? Show you again some results of a study that we did that we published in the late 1990s, because we wanted to answer this very specific question. We followed 491, we identified 491 episodes of fever in 257 residents of two large long-term care facilities here in Winnipeg prospectively. 76% of the episodes we were able to enroll for data collection and specimen collection, and this was 73% of all of the residents. So a large number and a large proportion of all the episodes of fever that occurred in those residents. And now these were nursing homes that dealt with fairly complex individuals, and about 5 to 10% of them had chronic indwelling catheters, so they were not entirely free of catheters. The first thing I want to show you is that this group of individuals, as with any highly impaired, a functionally impaired nursing home resident, had a very high prevalence of bacteriuria. And you can see that at the time that the fever was identified, and that's this initial column here, depending on what the clinical site of infection was thought to be, the urine cultures were positive anywhere from 32 to 88% of the time, and overall 50% had positive cultures. Almost all of these individuals got antibiotics for these episodes of fever. And 4 weeks later, when we repeated their urine cultures, you can see that the prevalence of bacteriuria was exactly the same. So all of that antibiotic therapy didn't make any difference with respect to whether or not they had positive urine cultures. So we identified 151 episodes that they had fever, but there were no localizing findings. So using standard criteria, we were unable to say what the source was. 140 were associated with respiratory symptoms. 26 had localizing genitourinary symptoms. 25 had gastrointestinal symptoms, so this was usually diarrhea and vomiting. And 13 had skin and soft tissue infection. What we had done with a collection of specimens here, we also collected blood. And we had developed a serological test which allowed us to look at whether there was an antibody increase to the bacteria that were present in the urine in these individuals. So, in fact, this is just like any other serologic test where you do an acute and a convalescent specimen and look for an antibody increase to tell you what the infection was due to. So we were looking here for an antibody increase to the organisms that were in the urine. I won't to talk to you at all about the data, but we had in fact validated this as a test for invasive urinary infection. What you can see here is that on the left side in this slide, these are all our individuals who had negative urine cultures. One individual amongst this group of about several hundred had an increase in antibody rise. If we look at people who had positive urine cultures with Enterobacteriaceae, there are a few there with antibody increases. With others, so those are Pseudomonas aeruginosa, Enterococcus, one or two, not many. individuals with an indwelling catheter are pulled out separately, and you can see there may be a few more of those who have antibody increases. If we look at the group that we thought, based on symptoms, could have genital urinary infection, and all we required here was one single symptom that pointed to the genital urinary tract, so we were very permissive about our diagnosis, you can see that, in fact, only about 50% of them had antibody increases as well. So even there, there were a certain proportion that did not, in fact, have their cause of fever due to urinary infection. If we summarize this, we found an antibody response consistent with invasive urinary infection in 43% of the individuals with localizing genital urinary symptoms. And only 11% of that group that had a positive urine culture and had no localizing findings, 4% gastrointestinal, 0.8% respiratory. Now, I'm not going to talk about the gastrointestinal and respiratory ones, but just to tell you that this test that we did actually picked up any Enterobacteriaceae. So if you had a gastrointestinal infection that was invasive with an E. coli, you would get an antibody rise. And if you had a gram-negative organism like an E. coli or Klebsiella causing your respiratory infection, you'd get an antibody rise as well. That's a different story about how gram-negative organisms don't cause respiratory infections in long-term care facilities. We're talking about urinary infection today. But what this shows you is that group of individuals with no localizing findings but a positive urine culture, only 11% of them had urinary infection. And what that means is if you call that presentation symptomatic urinary infection, you are wrong 90% of the time. Just a few other ways of looking at this. We looked for, well, if in those individuals who did have an antibody increase and positive urine cultures, were there any sort of characteristics that would separate out those who did have an increase versus those who didn't? And they were the usual. They were known to have underlying abnormalities. They had had prior symptomatic urinary infection or, and no surprises here, the most important thing, the presence of a chronic indwelling catheter. So actually, if you have somebody who's got a chronic indwelling catheter and a fever, the likelihood that that is, in fact, true urinary infection is much higher than if that chronic indwelling catheter isn't there. And just finally, if you have a fever and positive urine culture, the positive predictive value for this being symptomatic urinary infection, if there are no localizing findings, is only 12%. Very bad indeed, eh? Well, what can you call symptomatic urinary infection, since it appears that there's all sorts of things that you can't call symptomatic urinary infection? Well, pyelonephritis, and you can make this diagnosis in long-term care facility residents even when they have difficulty communicating with you because, of course, if there's cost of vertebral angle tenderness, you can often assess that even in somebody who's non-communicative but because of their response to pain. Certainly, if they have bacteremia and the organism is similar to the urine, high probability the urine is the source, although it's not 100%. And then there's also a group of individuals who may have acute lower tract irritative symptoms, so acute dysuria. And again, you say, well, how are you going to know this in a long-term care resident? But I've spoken to many nursing staff who work closely with some of these residents, and I'm sure many of you have this experience as well. They can tell when they take them for toileting when it's now uncomfortable for them and it wasn't before. If there's increased frequency, urgency, or acute incontinence, there are other things that can do this, like diuretics, for instance. But if they do have acute irritative-type symptoms, it is suggestive that this is a real urinary tract infection, symptomatic urinary infection. But what is not a symptomatic urinary infection is clinical deterioration without any fever and with no localizing genital urinary findings. Foul-smelling urine may well be because they have got bacteria in their urine, but that is not symptomatic urinary infection that warrants antibiotic therapy. You deal with that by trying to increase fluids or figure out other ways of dealing with continence management. And cloudy urine, which is often but not always because there's pyuria in the urine, is also not symptomatic UTI and does not warrant antimicrobial therapy. So, when do you treat with antibiotics? The first thing I want to do is just show you that we do a very bad job of treating urinary tract infection in long-term care facility residents. This is a study from one of my colleagues, Mark Loeb, in Southern Ontario, and they looked at antibiotic use in a group of Ontario long-term care chronic care facilities, which is the most highly impaired group of individuals, and some of you who are on this teleconference maybe work in some of these facilities. And they found that in terms of did the initiation of antibiotic therapy meet criteria, standard accepted surveillance definitions for infection? They found that 58% of the time for lower respiratory infection it did, 65% for skin and soft tissue infections, but for urinary infections, 28% of the time. And most of the reasons why 72% of the time they didn't meet surveillance definitions is because people had positive urine cultures and some other symptoms that were not urinary symptoms, but everybody wants to treat that positive urine culture. And the other thing is that if you compare the treatment of symptomatic urinary infection, even if we are willing to accept that it is appropriate to treat in women in long-term care facilities versus the community, for reasons that have not been fully explained, if you happen to be in the long-term care facility, you are 83 times more likely to have an excessive duration of antibiotic therapy, 7 times more likely to have an excessive dose, 10 times more likely to have adverse drug effects, and 3 times more likely to be retreated with 1 week. I think this is one of the problems with being in a long-term care facility. People are watching you too closely, and you tend to get overtreated. So we have major problems with how we use antibiotics for treating symptomatic urinary infection. And a large part of that relates to what we've already been talking about, which is how do you make a diagnosis of symptomatic urinary infection? Well, again, this is a consensus conference that Mark pulled together and to develop a minimum criteria for initiation of antibiotics. And this was for anything, not just for urinary infections, but it was broken out. And I believe that Mark and Stevenson in Idaho have been attempting to validate these, and I haven't seen the data from the validation yet. But this was a consensus conference of a group of individuals, including myself, who have worked for a long period of time in long-term care facilities and have a specific interest in this. I hope most of you aren't hearing awful construction that's going on beside me. It's going to go on for 6 more weeks, I'm told. If you want to start antibiotics for urinary tract infection, this consensus conference suggested that it would be appropriate to do that in individuals who don't have indwelling catheters, if they have acute dysuria, okay, it's painful for them to pass their urine, or if they have a fever, and one other genital urinary symptom, urgency, frequency, suprapubic pain, gross hematuria, costovertebral angle tenderness, acute urinary incontinence, okay? However, if they have a chronic indwelling catheter, it is appropriate to start antibiotics for urinary infection if there's a high temperature, if there's costovertebral angle tenderness that wasn't there before, if they have rigors, or if they have a new onset of delirium. So if you want some advice about, well, when should I treat, this is what I would suggest to you should be attempting to deal with now. Now, I know that there's all sorts of people who just want to treat positive urine cultures and pus in the urine, but this is an attempt to try and move us towards a more rational and appropriate use of antibiotics. And I know that Mark and some of his colleagues are looking at validating these recommendations, and so hopefully within a short period of time, we're going to have some of that data. What about the choice of antibiotics? As I told you previously, it's no different for the elderly. Certainly, there's been great popularity with the use of fluoroquinolones, norfloxacin, ciprofloxacin, levofloxacin, and now gadifloxacin, moxifloxacin in elderly populations, and these often work. There is no question, though, that they have been overused in long-term care facility residents, not just for UTI, but also for skin infections and for respiratory infections. And there is a greatly increasing number of reports of fluoroquinolone resistance as a result of this. So, you know, if possible, it's nice to stay away from the fluoroquinolones. And if you have a urine culture result before you start your antibiotics, that's often the case. The other issue that comes up is how long should you treat it if you think it's a lower tract infection or a bladder infection. 3 days therapy, which is what we like to use in well women in the community, may or may not be sufficient. But the absolute maximum should certainly be 7 days and more, no longer than 7 days. And we do need some further studies with respect to duration of therapy. So use standard therapy if they have an acute infection with genital urinary localizing symptoms. Now, what do you do if somebody looks really sick and you're really concerned about them, but there are non-localizing symptoms, or you're not sure about the symptoms and you've been watching them for a few days and you don't know what's happening? Most of these are not going to be urinary tract infection. However, If you find yourself in a situation where you really feel that you have to treat, and there are a number of reasons for that. Number one, they're just too sick. Number two, it's good, you know, it's nice to say, well, what you should be doing is monitoring these patients, but that's often not feasible to do given how seldom physicians can visit long-term care facilities or how many long-term care facilities might have nurse practitioners. If you do start antibiotics in that situation, I really feel that you need to sort of, in your own mind, say, I am starting these antibiotics because I think this is a urinary infection and these are the symptoms I'm looking at and I'm going to look for a response for. And I do feel that that needs to be documented in the patient chart as well. If you start antibiotics, you should be able to, you should document why you're doing it, because these are dangerous drugs in many cases. What about longer-term antibiotics? Well, I suppose you could use prophylactic therapy as we do in individuals who are in the community, which is if they have very frequent infections, especially women with lower tract infections. But quite frankly, because you are able to monitor these individuals so closely, if they do become symptomatic, you can treat them fairly rapidly. And so I'm not sure that prophylactic antibiotics are really necessary, and certainly they haven't been evaluated. As I'm sure you're all well aware, there are one or two studies that have looked at intravaginal estrogen. We are a long way from having sufficient data to say that we should be using intravaginal estrogen to prevent urinary tract infection in long-term care facility women. Suppressive therapy is rarely needed, and this is where you give high doses for a very long term. These are in individuals who have repeated episodes of invasive infection, have abnormalities of the genitourinary tract, stones, obstruction, tumors, that you can't do anything about. So very, very seldom would you use that. Now, the last question really was, when, if ever, do you have to consider doing investigations? Again, when we first started our studies, we were wondering that question as well, and this is our initial study that we did on those two wards, those older men. There were 88 on the two wards, and 48 of them had positive urine cultures during the 2 years of follow-up. Of that 48, in fact, 24 or half of them had already had previous urologic interventions. And, of course, this reflects the fact that so many men, as they get older, have bilateral prostatic hypertrophy. And so many of them had had previous investigations and were known either to have abnormalities that there was nothing to do about or to have no abnormalities. So that left us with only 24 individuals with positive urine cultures who had not had investigations. And we actually obtained intravenous pyelograms on 23 of the 24. This is the early 80s. So this is before ultrasound, before CT scan. Almost one-third of those individuals actually had abnormalities on the IVP, including bilateral calyceal clubbing, two with minor unilateral clubbing, and one with bladder calculi. For none of those was it felt that further interventions to deal with these abnormalities was appropriate. So routinely obtaining studies in individuals who are bacteriuric is certainly this study, and I believe that there's plenty of room for further studies with respect to this issue in long-term care facilities, would not suggest that that's an appropriate thing to do. When might you consider doing investigations in this final study? This is entirely my opinion, having thought about when would it be reasonable to do investigations in an individual in long-term care facility with symptomatic urinary tract infection. If they do not have an indwelling catheter, and they have an episode of bacteremia, then it is probably warranted, from a urinary source, because those individuals are quite likely to have an abnormality such as obstruction. If they're having recurrent episodes of fever that you can't find a source for or that you feel is due to urinary infection, then you should be investigating them again, because these are individuals who are likely to have abnormalities. Gross hematuria needs to be investigated because it could be a tumor. A renal failure, because urinary tract infection by itself does not cause renal failure. And so if they have renal failure, they need investigations for other reasons. And if there's acute retention, then appropriate investigations and management is necessary. In the individual who has an indwelling catheter, you might consider investigations in someone who has recurrent documented urosepsis with positive blood cultures. And what you're really thinking about there is that there's actually a reason for recurrent urosepsis if they have the chronic catheter, especially if there's trauma on it. But the presence of a chronic catheter also will greatly increase the likelihood that they could develop urolithiasis, either bladder stones or kidney stones. And so you may want to know whether or not they do have stones. Again, renal failure, because a chronic indwelling catheter does not give you renal failure. And if there is gross hematuria, especially repeated gross hematuria, but there's no good suggestion that is associated with catheter trauma. Again, because you're looking for stones, because you're looking for tumors, other things that can give you hematuria. So that is what I wanted to talk with you about today with respect to urinary tract infection. Obviously, there remain a lot of complexities, especially with respect to identification of symptomatic infection in individuals with positive urine cultures, as well as appropriate treatment strategies. But I think it is important that we think very critically about this issue, and I must say I think we understand a lot more about it now than we did 15 or 20 years ago. So I think that we have the opportunity for a few questions, and I'll turn it over to Paul Weber again.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Nicole.
Are you hearing all that noise in the background?
Just a little bit. It really isn't distracting at all. That's okay. We thought you were pounding on your desk.
That too.
That's really remarkable, the lack of evidence to use antibiotics on urinary tract infections. Is this a rapidly evolving study area? Are people doing a lot of work on this, and do you expect some new data in the not-too-distant future?
Well, I would say that the issue of treating asymptomatic bacteriuria is not rapidly evolving. Everybody agrees that that's appropriate. The difficulty there is that so many of the people who make decisions actually don't know the data, or, you know, they have other pressures, such as the family is bugging them about it or something. And in fact, the studies that are being done are looking at how you can convince people not to use antibiotics when asymptomatic bacteriuria is likely. The area that I think everybody would really like to see some clarification in is the specific identification of what is symptomatic infection in the patient who has somehow changed, has a positive urine culture, but there's a high probability that it's not, in fact, a urinary tract infection. I would have to say at the present time I'm not aware of a lot of work that's being done in that area, but it's an area of huge need, and I'm sure somebody at some point in time will pick up on it.
Yeah.
This is Lauren Tew, an infection control nurse calling from Bristol, England.
Yes, Lauren.
Hi. Dr. Nicole, you talked about the significance of pyuria or otherwise in patients without an indwelling catheter. What, in your opinion, is the significance of pyuria in patients with a long-term indwelling catheter?
It's the same, only more so. There is the odd patient who doesn't have an indwelling catheter in place and has bacteriuria who doesn't have pyuria. If you have an indwelling catheter in place, you will always have pyuria. It'll usually be a fairly high grade of pyuria as well. But in fact, in most cases, the degree of pyuria and the presence of pyuria probably relates to the presence of those 2 to 5 organisms that are always there in individuals with chronic catheters. In fact, in individuals who really don't have positive urine cultures with catheters, that few before they get it, they can have pyuria just because the catheter is there as well. So again, pyuria is not useful in terms of defining whether or not this is symptomatic and whether or not antibiotics are required.
This is Sharon Eustace, nurse consultant from Cornwall in England. Thank you, Dr. Nicole. What I'd like to ask is, what are your views on the role of chronic retention being a possible influencing factor on the presence of bacteria? And I was interested to note that it's not actually in your investigation list. And what are your thoughts on how that can be managed?
Yeah, well, I mean, chronic retention, to the extent that people have got increased bladder volumes over 500 cc's, is always bad. We know from other populations, I have not seen this data in an elderly population, but we know, for instance, from spinal cord injured populations, that if bladder volumes are above 500 cc's, there's a much increased occurrence of symptomatic urinary tract infection. And, of course, that's when you start to get reflux as well. So I'm not sure, these individuals certainly are more likely going to have positive urine cultures because they aren't emptying their bladder. It's as simple as that. But they also, if they have large volumes, will have more episodes of symptomatic infection. And so for that reason, I think what you're calling chronic retention, I also meant by the obstruction that I had there in terms of investigations. Mm-hmm. You do have to make sure that individuals are emptying their bladder. And so that needs to be done either by surgical means in some cases, by the use of intermittent catheterization in some cases. Rarely it's going to require the use of a chronic indwelling catheter as well, but you need to maintain low bladder volumes, and that's sort of the issue is not bacteriuria or positive urine cultures. The issue there is the bladder volume, and making sure that you keep the bladder volumes down. But all of that is sort of based on work in other populations, in elderly populations.
Okay, my name is Danielle. I'm in Campbell River, British Columbia.
Yes.
We have an extended care facility here. We often these are we take urine specimen for people that have dementia, and we notice an increased agitation or increased confusion, and I don't see any of that in your that's not a good idea.
I'm trying to figure out how to answer it. I would say in most cases that's going to be, first of all, those patients will almost always have a positive urine culture. So, you know, if anything causes them to have increased confusion, they're going to have a positive urine culture. So it's not really, you can't really attribute it to that positive urine culture. Sometimes individuals, whether they're demented or not, who do have real symptomatic urinary tract infection will certainly have an acute delirium associated with the infection. Almost always those individuals, if it is a true urinary source of infection, will have a high temperature, okay? And I know all the data about, you know, you don't have as high temperatures in the elderly, and sometimes they're afebrile. But in fact, most elderly individuals who have a severe invasive urinary infection will have a high temperature if the temperature is taken positively. So that would be one consideration. You know, and I was going to say something else about this, and it slipped my mind right now. But basically, unless you thought there was some element of delirium, unless they also had a temperature, I would certainly be looking for other causes of it, and I would try and hold off on either getting the urine specimen, because it's going to be positive much of the time, and certainly of giving antibiotic therapy in those individuals as well. Now, this is certainly, again, an area where it would be fabulous if somebody could do a good study. You know, that sort of a presentation in individuals who have dementia randomized to treatment or non-treatment and whether it makes any difference. The only study I'm aware of was actually one that was done in London, Ontario. And that study suggested that if they did not have a fever, there was not going to be any benefit from treating that as urinary infection. But it was a smallish study, and there was only a small number with urinary infection. They were looking at all infections there.
Great. Well, thank you very much for those questions. And Dr. Nicole, thank you for your answers. Obviously, your fame in this field is well-deserved.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Again, thank you all for joining our teleclass today. And thanks to Dr. Nicole for an outstanding presentation. Until we meet again, goodbye.